It's Monday, February 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, deep fighting erupts on several fronts in Syria amid efforts to stop it. Political battle lines are being drawn as a Supreme Court justice suddenly dies.
Uganda is one of those countries where the culture of debate is not deeply entrenched.
Presidential debates make their way to Central Africa. Also ahead, Pillow Talk is the One Direction in music. It's all on today's International Edition. The multi-sided war raging in Syria became even more tangled when Turkish troops shelled positions near the border controlled by U.S. allied fighters from the Kurdish People's Protection Units, or YPG. Turkey's prime minister confirmed the overnight Saturday artillery barrage and demanded the YPG withdraw from the Syrian border town of Azaz and vacate a nearby air base the Kurds seized last week from Syrian rebel forces. The Turkish shelling continued on Sunday. The Kurdish rebels, backed by the West and Gulf countries, have been battling for more than a week against a ferocious Russian-backed offensive by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces. President Barack Obama has called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the air campaign against moderate opposition forces in Syria. The White House says the two leaders spoke by phone to discuss agreements reached last week by the 17-nation International Syrian Support Group, or the ISSG. There was a cause for a cessation of hostilities, a term explained by VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins, as she spoke from Munich earlier with International Edition's Ira Melman.
Yes, the cessation of hostilities language is very interesting, and what Secretary Kerry said is the reason why they're using that language is because using the term ceasefire has more legal teeth. It's interesting because, as you may recall, in the lead up to this, one of the sticking points for the opposition was that they wanted a ceasefire. They were especially seeking relief from the Russian-backed Syrian strikes over Aleppo that had led to a humanitarian crisis. Now, interestingly enough, Secretary Kerry came out today. He was heading into a bilateral meeting with China's foreign minister, and he said to reporters he wanted to clarify something. And he said what they got last night with the International Syrian Support Group, with the cessation of hostilities, represented what the opposition wanted. In his words, he said the opposition called it and defined it as a cessation of hostilities. So a clarification from him. Of course, all of this will be interesting in how it plays out over the next days, whether or not there is a full agreement on the terms of this cessation.
There is some exclusion from this cessation of hostilities dealing with terrorist groups. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. The cessation, as it was explained by Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov, does not include terrorist groups. So this would, of course, not include groups such as the Islamic State. But one interesting point that Foreign Minister Lavrov made, he said that around the besieged city of Aleppo, terrorist groups were operating. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out going forward. It almost appeared that he left a little wiggle room for continued airstrikes.
Does this agreement, or what seems to be an agreement, set a date? The United States wanted an immediate ceasefire, and the Russians were saying, okay, ceasefire, but wait until March 1st. Is there a date set on this thing?
This is something that they hope to implement within the next week. Of course, the next few days will be telling in terms of how much of it can be put in place. Another interesting factor is that the United States and Russia, in particular Foreign Minister Lavrov and U.S. Secretary Kerry, are going to be chairing a task force that's going to look at a broader plan for implementing some type of cessation that would last for a longer period of time and have more lasting results in Syria.
VOA's Pam Dawkins. Well, we turn now to what's buzzing online. Our social media correspondent G. Abby Lee joins me here in the studio to bring us a story on YouTube Millionaire. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, who are we talking about?
Her name is Michelle Phan, and I know that's not a name a lot of men are familiar with, but trust me, a lot of our female listeners know who she is. She posts makeup tutorials on YouTube and has been doing that since 2006. Now, within that time, Phan uploaded more than 350 videos and received more than 1.1 billion views so far. She also has more than 8.3 million subscribers.
Wow, that's a lot of fans. Well, now that you mention it, I think I may have heard of her. Now, why is she making headlines this weekend?
Well, great question, because of an article by Mashable. It's titled, Why Michelle Phan is Starting Over. Now, whenever you hear of a widely successful person, especially a public one like her, starting over, that piques people's interest. YouTube is how Phan started her career, but from YouTube, she was able to start a beauty empire, which, according to the article, she will try to deconstruct, hence the title.
Well, I see. Tell us a couple.
Well, she started a lifestyle network called Icon and a beauty subscription service called Ipsy. I'm sure you're familiar with all this. She also partnered with L'Oreal to launch her own line of cosmetics called M. Ipsy is doing okay. I actually tried it myself despite being in a red ocean, but M, the makeup line, is an utter failure. And the comment section on their Mashable's Facebook page reflects that.
Ouch. Well, what did people write?
Many comments by male readers were, who is that? But to give you some substance, here is one from a reader who knows of Phan and her businesses. She wrote, I'm not a fan of the M brand. Not impressed with the quality at all. Hope she can turn it around. Maybe have a chat with Sam and Nick over at Pixie Woo. Real Techniques seems to be doing well. So this comment is in relation to another YouTube account called Pixie Woo, run by two women, who created a makeup brush company and is doing pretty well with that. Unlike Michelle Phan, who created a makeup line and has been struggling with that. So a lot of YouTubers make money not only from the AdSense, but also by utilizing their YouTube fame. Jim?
Well, thanks so much, G, for that update. You can follow G. Abby Lee on Twitter by that very same name, at G. Abby Lee, or through our program's account at VOA_IE. I'm out there as well, at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has died suddenly of natural causes at his ranch in Texas. He was 79. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins me in the studio to discuss the unusual timing of this in a presidential election year.
Antonin Scalia wasn't a particularly tall man, but he was considered a giant in jurisprudence. And whether you loved him or you hated him, the man was larger than life. This is something of an earthquake in Washington and for the nation. It is not typical that we have a Supreme Court vacancy during an election year. Typically, the justices, if they're going to retire, they tend to announce that retirement in a non-election year. But of course, here we have an unexpected death, so that throws a wrench into things. But before we get into the politics of it, this is a man who had some very conservative conservative and impactful opinions, whether you are talking about detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, whether you're talking about the Voting Rights Act. We're talking about things that really impact the fabric of our society. And he wrote some quite important opinions on those two matters, among many others, during almost 30 years on the Supreme Court. But he was also known for probably the most colorful dissents in the history of the Supreme Court. He wrote a dissent when the Supreme Court upheld the President's Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Mm-hmm. Justice Scalia did not like the legal rationale for that majority opinion, and he wrote a dissent, and he described the legal thinking in that opinion as applesauce and jiggery pokery. Now, I don't know what that means. But let's just say that that was a first.
Yes, it was.
In legal reasoning.
Well, now the decision is for President Obama to select a new nominee. And the interesting setup we have here is that we have a Republican-controlled Congress. We have very vocal Republicans running for the presidency. And they're saying, no, you have to wait and let the next president pick the replacement for Justice Scalia. And we've got, I don't know what, 9 months before the general election and another 10 or 11 before a new president is actually sworn in. Seems to me that's an awful lot of time to let this go by. And I think President Obama probably has every right in the world to select a Supreme Court justice.
President Obama can and will nominate a successor for Antonin Scalia. It is up to the Senate to decide what to do with it. Now, the Senate's majority leader, Mitch McConnell, put out a statement saying that the Senate is not going to be taking up a nominee while President Obama is in office, and that it is up to his successor, whoever that may be, a Democrat or a Republican, to nominate someone, and that then the Senate will act. And in fact, the other Republicans have fallen in line behind McConnell, including two senators who are running for president, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz on the Republican side. And they say, look, we are in an election year, and this is something that a lame duck president should not be selecting. Of course, technically, President Obama isn't a lame duck until after the election in November. But the point seems to be that in the last of 8 years of the Obama presidency, that maybe this is something that's best left to his successor. Democrats say, you know, you may not like the president who's in power, but the people elected President Obama in 2008. They reelected him in 2012. His term does not end until the oath of office is given to his successor, I believe, on January 17th of 2017. And until then, President Obama has every right to nominate someone and to expect that the Senate will hold a vote.
Serving for a long time for us, Michael Bowman, VOA Senate correspondent, and we wish you a grand career as far as you want to take it, Michael. I don't know if this is a job for life, but you're certainly welcome.
Well, thank you, Jim, and it's always a pleasure.
Presidential debates, of course, are common here in the United States and in many other parts of the world. Voters in Uganda got their first taste of such a conversation when they tuned in Saturday for their nation's first ever presidential debate attended by all of the candidates in Kampala. Many say it was a small victory for democracy. Lizbeth Pollat reports from Kampala.
In homes and bars across the country, Ugandans were fixated on their screens as the eight political candidates running for president took part in the national debate. Those who could not watch tuned in on their cell phones, cheering and applauding as candidates addressed issues important to them. At the forefront was President Yoweri Museveni, who was running for his fifth term in office. Speculation over whether President Museveni would attend the debate was rampant throughout the capital, up until the moment he stepped onto the red carpet at the debate hall. Excitement was high as the debate got underway.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have a full house.
Crispy Kaheru, a coordinator with the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, attended the debates and said it shows an important shift in how citizens are encouraging political dialogue in Uganda.
Uganda is one of those countries where the culture of debate is not deeply entrenched. And seeing us making baby steps in that direction is very much encouraging. Mm-hmm. And beyond a debate of this nature, I think it lays a foundation for dialogue processes mm-hmm. to happen post the election, which is important for this country.
This was a sentiment shared by many, including Jermaine Igesa, who says the organization of the event and questions posed gave him a feeling of empowerment.
I must say it makes sense discussing foreign policy mm-hmm. with the incumbent who has been largely in charge of the foreign policy. It made a lot of sense for me. Mm-hmm. On the overall, I think it's a telling statement for people who do not believe Africa can actually practice democracy. I mean, I have been to foreign countries. I know how some stereotypes are about African politics, but I think it's a telling statement. There were no fist fights. There was no name calling. It was very civil. It's been very decent. Everybody has put their best foot forward.
Supporters of President Museveni, such as Susan Ojira, said she was glad Museveni could attend the debates this time and that she preferred his straightforward style to answering questions.
The other time, when he was so busy, they started speculating that he's fearing the debate. Why should he fear debate? We feel honored. He shall feel excited because we are sure of his answers. According to the last debate, actually, it was just some candidates were failing to answer straight questions. Some were dodging questions.
Although many citizens have already picked their preferred candidate, some say the debates help them choose who to vote for. Voting in Uganda is scheduled to take place this Thursday. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA. The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Right now, Zayn Malik is one of the most requested artists, and he's reached a milestone in his musical career, and he's done it alone. We're anything but alone as VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us with some pillow talk from the music world.
Well, One Direction has always been popular in America, but they were never a chart-topping act. They got to number 2 on the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles chart, and that was it. With one single, ex-member Zayn Malik outdoes them because his debut solo single, Pillow Talk, opens at number 1 on the latest edition of the Hot 100 chart. So he has outdone his old group. And Zayn also opened at number 1 over in the United Kingdom. Last March, Zayn very publicly split from One Direction. And he said, well, look, I was never really happy in the group. My personal musical tastes, the music I like to perform, was not what One Direction performed. So I never really felt like I was a member of the band. Now the world can see the real me. And apparently the world likes the real Zayn. He's going by his first name now, Zayn.
Well, alphabetically puts him at the back of the pack, but he's on the top of the heap. Good trade-off.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have Adele at one end and Zayn on the other, so you have two British bookends for the American pop chart. The video stars his girlfriend Gigi Hadid, and of course that's gotten him a lot of play. And his debut album, Mind of Mine, will drop on March 25th, which is 1 year to the day after he left One Direction, and sources are saying that this is no accident. He wants to send a message that he is now well and truly over One Direction. It kind of makes you wonder how the other members are feeling about it, because One Direction is now
on hiatus. And the party line is that this is going to be a temporary hiatus, and they're eventually just going to regroup and they're going to continue. But signs point in another direction. Another direction
wow,
from one direction.
A new direction.
Harry Styles recently signed with a new manager, Jeffrey Azoff. Sources say his new handlers want to launch Harry's solo career about this time in early 2017. So Harry is looking ahead. Niall Horan wants to open a sports management agency specifically to handle golfers because he's a huge golf nut. Lewis Tomlinson is a new father. He has a little baby boy named Freddie with a woman out in California named Brianna Youngworth. So he has his hands full. Liam Payne reportedly wants to work on songwriting. So all of these guys have a pretty clear-cut idea of what they want to do. And when you look at the origins of One Direction, it's not really surprising. Back in 2010, they all individually auditioned for The X Factor in the United Kingdom. And they were later assembled into a group and, of course, went on to achieve huge success. But they weren't childhood friends. They didn't sing together in school. There was no real unity. They were just pressed into service together.
Well, they're all going in many directions. We always go in the musical direction each week with Ray McDonald, your host of VOA's Top 20 Countdown. Also, follow Ray on Twitter.
Ray on the hits.
Thanks so much for joining us, Ray.
You got it, Jim. It's a paradise, and it's a war zone.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us any time of the day or night that you like right on our very own website, voanews.com. We're also out there on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. Well, we just heard from Zayn Malik and One Direction. Always keeping us in the right direction is our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for taking a little bit of your day and spending it with us. Come back again and have a good one.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and India face a common challenge, overcoming the threat of terrorism. The rise of groups like ISIL underscores the limits of conventional approaches. We need a broader, bolder, and smarter approach to turn back terrorism, said Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, one that goes beyond countering terrorists with our military, intelligence, and law enforcement tools to also preventing people from becoming terrorists in the first place. The best way to do that is through a comprehensive approach that calls for partnerships at every level between government and civil society. Public officials play a role by governing effectively and upholding the rule of law. At the same time, religious, business, and academic leaders need to challenge violent extremism and promote messages of peace. Religious leaders are among the most critical actors in pushing back against violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. They can teach curious young minds tenets of faith and refute extremist interpretations that exalt violence. Across India, from Kerala to Kashmir, faith communities are mobilizing to challenge violent extremism. 1.5 million Muslims from the region gathered in Uttar Pradesh last month to reject global terrorism and affirm the Quran's injunction that killing one innocent person is equivalent to killing all humanity. More than 70,000 clerics from around the world gathered in Bareilly to condemn ISIL as inhuman and un-Islamic. And in Delhi, students at a local college lit candles to outshine ISIL's darkness as Muslim women raised their voices to decry ISIL for carrying out such inhuman acts in the name of Allah. Governments can help by ending stifling regulations on civil society and allowing citizen groups to peacefully speak and organize around sensitive topics. They can go a step further by proactively reaching out to build ties with communities targeted by violent extremists for recruitment, like in Maharashtra, where local police are partnering with local clerics to de-radicalize youth. As detailed in the U.S.-India Joint Declaration on Combating Terrorism, the U.S. stands shoulder to shoulder with India against this common threat, from expanding intelligence sharing to cracking down on illicit terrorist financing, better securing our borders, ports, and public transportation, and helping to train thousands of Indian security personnel. The United States and India are committed to pursuing a comprehensive approach to countering violent extremism by empowering local communities, embracing diversity, and staying true to shared common values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.